Hey everyone, thank you for joining. And while you're joining, Valeria unfortunately won't be with me today. She has to take care of some family business, like most Ukrainians. You know, taking care of their families in a war zone is a second job, full time job by now. But we'll keep it tight this time around. I wanted to remind everyone who's joining for the first time that Ukrainian Spaces, we launched together with Valeria some time ago, and the main goal is to amplify Ukrainian voices, but also decolonize Ukraine conversations on Twitter. So we see millions of Ukrainians, we know millions of Ukrainians with perfect English, sharing their stories across all social media platforms, yet the conversations about Ukraine are still dominated by Western, mostly white and mostly male folks. Not only it continuously robs Ukrainians of their agency, it also perpetuates outdated, misleading, and false narratives about Ukraine and Ukrainians. So we want to foster a relaxed, chill, and safe space for Ukrainian voices to express themselves without the need of fitting Western boxes. And the rest can use the space to educate themselves and to decolonize their views of Ukrainians. And before I actually invite our guest, honorary guest today, I wanted to you know, read you something out loud. This is kind of a new tradition. We last week we read you a first person account from Mariupol, and today I came across this report. It's not a report. It's first a collection, first hand accounts from the western suburbs of Kyiv. Those, you know, 3-4 cities that are now associated with the worst crimes in the Ukrainian genocide: Irpin, Hostomel. So our friends at Zaborona, which is a very cool independent newsroom in Ukraine, they posted the accounts of doctors from Bucha, one of the cities that were and still the most affected by Russian mass murdering campaign. So here's like three accounts that actually the most powerful was most powerful for me as I was reading through them. The first one is from Larisa Alexeyevna. She's the head nurse at one of the Bucha hospitals. So she writes, "We got lost in the dates. We get exhausted for a couple of hours and close our eyes, and then there is another explosion, another shooting. The patients sleep in their beds. The staff sleeps anywhere, on a mattresses or a sofa or a chair. You rest and then you work and work and work, and many of us do not know where our relatives are or whether they are alive, but we don't think about it at all. All of us are needed here and now, and not just the soldiers that come into the hospitals, but whole families and children. It's hard to bear." Inna Shogolyva, the chief doctor of the maternity hospital in Vorset. It's also a suburb in west of Kyiv. "We put on our bulletproof vests and go to the operating room. There are 5 windows there. Can you imagine? The windows are tapped. Tanks are coming. Their muzzles revolving. We just operate on the victim. He's still on the operating table and we're all lying on the floor. A woman gives birth in the corridor. It's scary in the delivery room because everything is under covered with glass. Orcs stand on the streets outside the hospital and fire from morning till night. We all sleep in the corridor on mattresses, and women with newborns, of course, too. We watch TV. We hear something about Hostomel, Bucha, and Irpin, but nothing about us. I think, God, nobody knows about us." And here's the last one from Anton Dovopol. He's the chief doctor in Bucha, in one of the Bucha hospitals. I saw shot cars with children, scattered toys, burned corpses. I saw dogs eating people's bodies. We collected the bodies of those who died in the hospital and those brought to the pathological anatomy department. We tried to identify them, dug a mass grave. We buried 67 bodies on the church's grounds. Yeah, so I think, I know that's gruesome, but I feel like every time I still try to share as much as possible of these first-person accounts, because at the end of the day, these stories must be heard. I know that's gruesome, but at the same time, those people share them for the world to hear, and that's why it's paramount that we keep sharing them as much as possible. Okay, so come on, guys. Now I'm trying to invite our guest.
Hear me now.
Yes, I can hear you perfectly.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I have missed your introduction of myself,
I just
unfortunately.
only started. I only just
Right,
started.
right, right.
I was
Okay, I will
telling
humbly
people.
listen.
No, I was telling people that we started, talking long time ago, but I specifically remember just before the war started, we were like exchanging these anxious messages in between, like because, both of our parents are in Zaporizhia, were in Zaporizhia. We were exchanging anxious messages like, will it happen? Will it not happen? Will the war start? Where will, what should we do? And then at some point, I know that you were already in Lviv in Western Ukraine. Feel free to share whatever you feel comfortable sharing in terms of your family. This is the question that I always ask everyone Ukrainians here. Like how's your family doing? And are they all safe?
Of course, Maxim. Well, my family is now in Germany, which is as safe as one can get these days. They were in Zaporizhia on the day of the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February. And then they traveled through jammed roads and spent 24 hours in the car to get to Lviv, where I was waiting for them. That was quite a scary moment in our family history. But since then, I have managed to send them abroad, and now they are safe. Luckily, how is your family?
Well, it is what it is. They're still there. But I'm just wondering, my impression was you were so composed. We were exchanging like whether we should take our parents out immediately. And you were like so chill about it. And it could be my impression. But then at the end of the day, your parents are in full safety. Mine are not. But how did you figure out? I was totally oblivious until the very last hour. I was like, oh, it's gonna pass, it's gonna be fine, which is fine reaction. But yeah, what was it like for you those days before, and why you decided that, yeah, this is the time to act. I need to do it now. I need to get my loved ones in safety now.
Yes. Well, I think I had an intuition while still being in London this winter, at the beginning of winter, that this mass scale Russian troops amassment at the Ukrainian border would not just pass, and that I need to get back to my homeland and to see my parents and my loved ones to safety if needed. But I can't actually, articulate this nightmarish reality when it's not yet come to pass. But when the Russian invasion started, I got all the alarms, and I just yelled them on the phone to get into their car and not to waste a minute.
I see.
Yes, I'm quite happy with how that part of the story turned out, which is to say I was luckier than most people in Ukraine. I had resources to get my parents to safety. They had a safe route through Poland into Germany. And most of Ukrainians who waited a bit longer are now stranded in cities like Chernihiv, Mariupol, and Kharkiv without the resources and the resolve to get out.
Okay. Yeah. Look, I wanted to take this opportunity because I'm a huge fan of your work. You're academic, but you spend so much time actually educating the rest of the world before the war started about Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian kick-ass women in Ukrainian history, and their absolutely outstanding role in anti-colonial fight of Ukraine. I don't think that people even realize how important, how integral voice of Ukrainian women has always been through the centuries of Ukrainian anti-colonial fight. So can you tell me what a person, a woman from Zaporizhia, how do you end up doing that on this journey? Because I'm just saying, because Zaporizhia is a fantastic, you know, city in eastern Ukraine, Kazakh capital, former Kazakh capital, but you know, unfortunately, we don't see too many academics coming from Zaporizhia because life is hard there. It's been hard. You know, I know that you come from a bit fancier neighborhood than I come.
It was a journey, Maxim. Yeah.
Yeah. But tell me, please, like, how do you end up doing that? Because the first time I checked you, I was like, wow, this must have been an enormous journey for you.
Right. Thank you so much for your praise. It's amazing to hear this from a person whom I admire personally for raising awareness of Ukraine and our political nation and our struggles internationally on such a high level and for so long. I'm also very happy to find another fellow Zaporizhian native on the internet and out there beyond the city's limits. Speaking for our country. I would add another voice to this Zaporizhian chorus, and it's Serhiy Plukhy, the Harvard professor of Ukrainian history, who has written very prolifically on Ukraine and its significance and its places, the gate of Europe and its history of cultural, military resistance to neighboring empires.
Yeah, go Zaporizhia, gang.
Go Zaporizhia, indeed. I'm currently a special projects curator at the Ukrainian Institute London. But, I can say that Putin's invasion has made my work irrelevant in some ways, because now I don't have to explain to the world anymore why Ukraine matters so much, because it becomes quite obvious to everyone. My most recent project is called Ukraine Lab, which is a writing residency where we hope to show to the world that the key to solving world's most urgent issues lies within Ukraine, whether it is environmental issues or disinformation or modern warfare. In all of these spheres, Ukraine has amassed certain experience through crises like the Chernobyl catastrophe when it comes to the environment, or the ongoing war with Russia, which actually started 8 years ago, more than 8 years ago, or disinformation campaigns. Well, we had the experience of being attacked by Russian trolls, and they sort of started their international campaign with Ukraine. So we've amassed that experience, and we've also amassed strategies of resistance that I hope the world would be interested in learning. But the project is supposed to be taking place while the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine has started. And all of these crises, all of these different experiences are as acute as they have ever been. And it is quite obvious to everyone now, I think, that whether it is environment or war or disinformation, it is indeed Ukraine that has answers to all these questions. And it is the support of our victory in our struggle against this massive neo-imperialist invasion that will eventually solve these problems.
Well, I'm super happy that you're optimistic about it. I'm less so optimistic about that it will, you know, it will end this, you know, these kind of things across the world. Unfortunately, genocides or colonialism or other things that we're experiencing in our lives have been with us through most of the human history. I do hope so that the story of Ukrainian struggle will help people to be more engaged on the issue and kind of associate themselves more, especially those from rich countries. I wanted to, you know, Val is not with us. She's co-founder, co-boss for Ukrainian Spaces, but she's posted on her Instagram, and you should definitely check her Instagram. She's doing fantastic work on visualizing a lot of cool facts about Ukraine. And she posted recently a thread on Instagram about Ukraine's spirit of resistance through female voices. Mm-hmm. And she features Lesya Ukrainka, Natalia Kobrinska, Maria Primachenko, you know, and Natalia Polonska-Vasilenko, Alla Horska, many others who were powerful anti-colonial female voices in Ukraine and kind of shaped the voice of Ukrainian anti-colonial struggle. But specifically, she's a huge fan, as yourself, of Lesya Ukrainka. This is, you know, for us, this is a name that we know since like kindergartens, right? We can recite their poetry, her poetry, but for the rest of the world, he's still kind of really shocked that people do not know much about her. And she's centered her writings on Ukrainian independence and the decolonial fight. But I know you're a huge fan. And explain me why.
I am indeed.
I know why you're to others. Explain to others.
I think that Lesya Ukrainka is a perfect example of Ukrainian resistance and resilience. She is a very powerful anti-colonial voice. She wrote at the beginning of the 20th century, so she's this fin de siècle woman in a white-collared blouse. She comes from an aristocratic family. She is highly educated. She knows 12 languages. She translates, she writes, she educates, and she subverts the Russian misrepresentation of Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian literature, this provincializing view of Ukrainian culture as only fit to describe, you know, peasant life. And only fit for folk songs. She is raising the level of Ukrainian culture to engage with the archetypal plots in world literature, specifically in European literature. So she, instead of only writing about Katrusias and Maruses, she engages with these world themes like the Trojan War in her drama Cassandra, or the story of the Don Juan in her drama The Stone Host. And she sort of introduces these incredible rich themes into the Ukrainian literature. And while doing this, she also makes another turn, and she tells these archetypal stories from a female point of view. Mm-hmm. So hers are retelling of these key European myths from a feminist perspective. For example, the story of the Trojan War is told by Lesya Ukrainka through the voice of Cassandra, the tragic prophetess who is cursed by gods to always know the truth but never to be believed by her compatriots. And I think this particular figure is so resonant today with so many Ukrainians who have been telling the world about the danger of the Russian escalation of the Russian war for decades, actually. and
Yeah.
have never been believed till lately. So Cassandra is becoming emblematic of our fight now. Lesya
Absolutely.
Ukrainka, she, like, Cassandra is a tragic heroine. Lesya Ukrainka is not a poet of, you know, hope and optimism, but she's a poet of an unbeatable moral clarity and resilience. And I think that this is the lesson that she can teach us.
Yeah, you can. I encourage everyone to check it. I mean, I think it's very powerful that you mentioned that it still resonates extremely well, especially today. So there were Ukrainians in 19th century and in 17th centuries who were writing this. And when you read it, especially these days, and I read a lot of it these days, you kind of shocked. I mean, I know it by heart since childhood, but now in this situation, you're shocked how relevant it is. So we've been, for generations, we've been trying to tell the world what is happening to help them understand it through anti-colonial power, anti-colonial fight against the imperial power, Russians, and yet people wouldn't listen. And yeah, but you know what? Before, yeah, I wanted to quote actually Lesya Ukrainka. This is something I found today, because he said that she's definitely not the most cheerful person. His life was shit.
Who
there.
Is these days? Who is these days?
Yeah, life was shit for Ukrainians there. It is now. But one of her most cheerful things that I actually, you know, I was like my whole insides warmed out when I was reading this morning. So this is a verse from her poem, Contra Spem Sparrow. And she writes, through all my tears, I still shall laugh, sing songs despite my troubles, have hope despite all odds. I want to live. Away your sorrowful thoughts. On this poor, indigent ground, I shall sell flowers of flowing colors. I shall sell flowers even amidst the frost and water them with my bitter tears. And from those burning tears will melt the frozen crust so hard and strong. Perhaps the flowers will bloom and bring about for me a joyous spring.
Wonderful.
This is so relevant. It's just, yeah, but, yeah, can you tell me more about the, you know, what do you think is the biggest misconception about, Western foreign misconception about a female powerful figure such as Lesya Ukrainka in Ukrainian history?
Yeah, of course. I think it ties nicely to this idea that Ukraine would be defeated in 3 days that was bought by most of the Western media who kept being surprised by our resistance and with our fight. Well, it's basically because of the acceptance of Russian misrepresentation of Ukraine as somehow lacking in agency, lacking in subjectivity. So I think the problem lies with the acceptance of the Russian misrepresentation of Ukraine as a political non-entity, as a nation that lacks subjectivity, lacks agency, and is somehow culturally insignificant. This is obviously supported by the Russian money and the imperial cultural dominance of Russia in the international cultural space. And I think that nowadays it is also exemplified by the resistance that Western cultural institutions are putting up against the demand to cancel, so to speak, Russian culture. To boycott Russian culture, not to invite Russian artists and Russian public intellectuals to some kind of reconciliatory roundtables with Ukrainians while Ukrainians are being slaughtered, literally, by the Russian army.
Yeah.
It's very important for us now to decenter this view of Eastern Europe and to counter the Russocentric view of our region with the more diverse, more polyphonic conception, which implies that Russian avant-garde is actually an umbrella term that is completely skewed, and it usually unites authors and artists of Ukrainian, Belarusian, Jewish origins. And it is the imperial dominance that has allowed Russia for so long to misrepresent all these cultures and to steal their cultural heritage.
Absolutely. We can talk about Ukrainian culture for like literally days, and I'm not even, academic or a specialist. I'm just, a regular person who's educated about it, and it just makes me mad, especially these days as we're going through genocide, that still Ukrainian culture is being linked on those arenas with Russian culture. And all initiatives when it comes to bringing light to our culture these days, very often, especially in Western institutions, are linked into the same arena with focus on Russian culture. And not only it reinforces the same colonial stereotypes that we're somehow like codependent or extension of, Russian culture, but it's also kind of a testament to how colonial cultures actually thrive by just taking all the space possible, appropriating whatever is possible from colonized cultures. And I think this is definitely what is still, happening, right? And this is still quite frustrating.
Precisely. And it's not only the international space where these ideas can take hold, but it's also the oppressor's ability to influence the our own conception of ourselves. So Lesya Українка is again a good example, and the way she was misrepresented to generations of Ukrainian pupils and students at school. So the basic rule when speaking about her while Ukraine was part of the Soviet Empire was the representation of Lesya Українка as this weak and sickly girl who
Oh,
had
yeah.
ill health, who was struggling physically throughout her life. You see, you undermine such a powerful poetic voice with this messaging. And the other streak of this misrepresentation was the view of Lesya Українка as this folk heroine. So the person who wrote well into her 40s, who was a mature, well-educated, deeply intellectual writer was mostly represented through her childish portraits in this Ukrainian Vinochok. I don't know what's ref would it be
Yeah,
ref?
flower breath. Yeah.
Yes. Her image was that of a girl and a sickly girl at that, and a girl with this low folkloric background, while in fact she was a highly educated woman of aristocratic origin who spoke, as I have mentioned, not spoke, who knew 12 languages and wrote some of the most powerful anti-colonial feminist cosmopolitan works in the world
Yes,
literature.
kick-ass feminist. She's one of
Exactly.
the strongest voice of feminists in 19th century in the whole Europe. And I think this is a very important point you're making. Something that a lot of people should also know about Russian colonial rule, that it's extremely macho and it's extremely disregarding to gender equality. And it's based on this extreme version of patriarchy. That's why, all these fantastic female voices that we had in our culture in Ukrainian, but also in Georgian culture, in Moldovan, Belarusian culture, in all other colonized by Russia cultures, they were misrepresented for us. I remember it since like I was a kid, although, I went to school during independence, early independence years, but still this representation was affected by decades and decades of rewriting and raising their voices. And yeah, another thing that I learned only later is that Lesya Ukrainka is also highly valued by queer community, because we don't know for sure if she was queer, because what was queer in 19th century anyway, but she had this fantastically warm and romantic and full of passion connection to other prominent writer. And her work is very pronouncedly queer and homoerotic as well. But what do you think? Was she queer though?
Well, we, as you say, we don't know. There is no document that would prove to us her queerness. And I think it's not as important as her writing, which is queer when we think about queerness as a transgression of patriarchal norms or and hierarchies. Then Lesya Ukrainka is as queer as it gets. Her intimate friendship with Olha Kubilinska, which is so the record of which has survived through their correspondence, through their letters, basically Lesya Ukrainka writing to her fellow feminist writer Olha Kubilinska, is the most beautiful queer writing you would probably encounter in Ukrainian and maybe European letters at the time. It's comparable to Virginia Woolf and Peter Sackville-West's romance in letters. It is also a proof that they were looking for some kind of new language while being surrounded by the patriarchal structures. Don't get me wrong, Ukrainian society at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century is also highly patriarchal. And these kick-ass feminists resist these structures by also stealing the language from the oppressor, from the masculinist literary discourse, and queering it, finding new structures to express their feelings for each other. And this is a beautiful exercise in resistance again. Lesya Ukrainka also has a beautiful short story, Priyaznь, or Sympathy, which looks into these deep, intense, romantic friendship between adolescent girls. And it is such a universal experience, I guess, for many of us. And many of us would recognize our feelings in this story. When we read it today, it sounds absolutely contemporary and relevant.
Yeah,
So, yeah.
one of my favorite her quotes is like, "As I die, the abandoned fire of my songs will burn in the world." In 20, she wrote it in late 19th century, 2022. Here we are. I think this is a moment where the world learns about, other anti-colonial voices powerful from Ukraine as well.
This is the hope.
Yeah. One very traditional question that we have for everyone is, what is frustrating you at the moment in the foreign coverage of Ukraine?
At the moment, I am frustrated by the lack of investment in Ukrainian victory. I think it has to be very clear for everyone that the only goal of Western engagement should be Ukrainian victory, not convincing Ukrainians to surrender to stop the bloodshed, not to prolong the bloodshed in any way, but just to invest in our victory, full stop. Ukrainians know too well that the bloodshed would never stop if Russians are allowed to dominate this place. We learn from history and from experience of the last 8 years in the occupied territories of Donetsk and Luhansk, and in the occupied Crimea that Russian rule in those territories means deportations means repressions, means cultural centers turned into concentration camps. This is not something that we will stand by. And the only goal for Ukrainians these days is victory. And if the West and the global community wants to support Ukraine, they have to provide the weapons, the military, the humanitarian assistance that we request.
And in terms of journalists, because I know that a lot of folks who requested to have these kind of conversations, they're also listening to us as well, and they're foreign journalists, and they always ask, like, okay, I mean, those are who are interested, you know, are good, good people who are really want to learn how to cover Ukraine better.
Of course.
I know that you also help a lot of foreign journalists these days. So what would you be kind of, you know, very relevant message to them, how they can cover Ukraine better and what is now is missing in that focus?
I have one anecdote, which is probably not very helpful, but I can't help myself. I will tell it. So I was contacted by a journalist from a prominent British media who requested my comment on the bombing of Lviv, where I'm currently based, and our schedules did not collide. So he told me that he's sure other opportunities will present themselves soon. Please be sensitive that when you're asking a person who is currently based in a city that is being bombed, telling them that other bombings will surely take place soon enough and they will be able to comment is not very appropriate. Otherwise, I would just ask not to engage in Russian discourse and not to repeat cliches of Russian propaganda and of Russian imperialist misrepresentation of Ukraine. Do not ask us how we are different from Russia. Read what we write. The answer is already there. Just look at our fight. The answer is quite obvious. We are a freedom-loving political nation.
Ukraine means freedom.
Our literature, exactly. Ukraine means love. Our literature is a testament to that.
Yeah, well, not everybody will have time for literature.
In this economy.
I really hope this opens up opportunity because there are a lot of good translations of our most famous writers and voices of Ukrainian culture, but also I hope it will open up a door for us to translate more and to share with the world more, because now, you know, before the war I started reading very intensely kind of newly emerged works by a so-called Ukrainian executed Renaissance, which was a whole generation of Ukrainian writers and artists executed by Russian colonialism, Russian Soviet rule in the 30s. And as I was reading through them, it was most powerful, but also most saddening experience in knowing that it's still possible, even to this day, to erase a generation, to erase the whole generation of voices who, you know, were channeling powerful truth, including powerful anti-colonial truth.
That's true. As you know probably too well, the house in Kharkiv, the so-called Slovo House, where most of that generation of writers were based, lived, was bombed by the Russian military. So that place has been partially destroyed. They keep erasing our history even today.
Absolutely. And it was a very powerful moment as well, a reminder. Is it something that you would suggest people to look for and educate themselves or to read these days when it comes to Ukrainian writing?
Absolutely. And I think that generation is particularly interesting because it combines the anti-colonial optics with socialist optics. There is this view of Ukraine as a deeply chauvinistic and nationalist country, thanks to whom, Actually, we have a powerful socialist tradition, Lisa Ukrainka. My heroine was a socialist, and so were some of the writers, most of the writers actually, of the executed renaissance of the 1920s. So it would be eye-opening indeed to engage with their ideas, with their writing, and to see where they were perhaps a bit blind to the Soviet ideology and what it did to them.
Oh, yeah, actually, it's a fantastic point. The most of them, executed Renaissance, were like kick-ass socialist and communist. And I was at first, I was a bit hesitated, you know, to dig deeper into it. And it's just, okay, you know, I'm not a fan of far right or far left ideology. But then when you read through it, this is like a missing link of all those people who claim to be anti-imperialist and anti-colonial in the West. They just completely ignore these kind of voices who were communist, far right, far left, far you know, socialist. However, they were very, very strongly anti-colonial as well, and they were very explicit about exposing Russian colonialism specifically. This just, especially how they actually learn through the process of you know, divorcing from any naivete about Soviet rule, and how they come to realize that this is just another stage of Russian colonial rule over Ukraine with just different name, right?
Yeah, it's a deeply tragic story. I would suggest looking into Mykola Khvilyovy, who was the leader of that generation and who was romanticizing the Soviet ideology. He was a revolutionary writer, and then after he witnessed the genocide of Ukrainian people, the so-called Holodomor of the 1932-1933, he was disenchanted, so to speak, with the Soviet ideology, and he could, well, his way of solving this moral, ethical issue was suicide. He killed himself. And many others of his fellow writers were sent to Gulag and were killed by the Soviets.
Look, I, yeah, I wanted to, you know, lastly to ask you in general, I know it's very hard to pack, and we will come back to this topic in general. But since you're coming from a bit similar background with me, from the same, you know, city, where there's always been very hard to come in terms of your Ukraine-ness, you know, kind of
Russian speaking. In terms of my sorry, I didn't catch that.
Ukraine-ness.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so I know I repeat it very often that for many people, especially those who come like from mixed background ethnically in Ukraine, like myself, it's been a choice to call yourself and identify Ukrainian. And I know that I suspect your journey was quite similar because we were raised not very often in the most kind of Ukraine-friendly environment, especially
of course
for places that basically is synonymous with Russian colonialism and erasure of Ukrainian identity, like Zaporizhia, for example.
Yes, indeed. I come from a Russian-speaking family in Zaporizhia, which till the arrival of the so-called Ruski Mir, Russian world, where the majority of families in Zaporizhia, more and more of them are switching to Ukrainian now for obvious reasons. I, well, only one of my grandparents was Ukrainian. I'm mixed Russian, Jewish, and Ukrainian person. And it was indeed a choice for me to engage with this project of Ukrainian statehood, Ukrainian liberation, Ukrainian resistance. I was seduced by the idea of freedom and resistance to what nowadays is absolutely obvious an evil empire to the east of us, I chose my Ukrainian identity, as many people in our region have done, and I'm very proud of doing that. It's a privilege and an honor and a responsibility.
Yeah. It's almost everyone who's been to our guests. Keep saying the same thing, because you know we want to feature as diverse voices as possible from Ukrainians, and this is always the message that this is the biggest misconception about Ukrainian identity, that it's related to race or ethnicity or other 20th century bullshit, when in
fact
it's 100% about values first, freedom, anti-colonial kick-ass values of freedom, democracy, equality as well.
We just rock, Maxim. It's just impossible to resist the allure of all these values. It's just a privilege to engage with people who are tied to this country, to this political, civic nation, and who are kicking ass these days.
Yep. Okay. Thanks so much, Sasha. It was like really, it was really touching and very cool. I know that we can talk about Ukraine culture, and we should talk about much more. We should concentrate on some specifics, but I'm really grateful for you to spend some time this to educate all of us about female anti-colonial voices in Ukrainian history and culture, and how they're so fucking relevant still until this very
day. It was my huge pleasure and privilege again. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's just amazing to hear from one of my heroes in the media space.
Yeah, thank you. This mutual fangirling will never stop.
Exactly.
Please keep the Ukrainian Spaces hashtag alive. Please suggest other guests, suggest topics, just vent something you find very frustrating about Ukraine's perspective of foreigners about Ukraine using this hashtag. We'll be all happy to amplify and invite you. And, you know, but thank you so much for your time. And we'll see you guys, everyone, most likely next Thursday. No plans for Ukrainians are possible more than 24 hours now. But it will be most likely the same time on Thursday.
Lovely. Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава.